Hello, this is Atah Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, April 8th, 2025, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page, DeWitt County gaining hands-on experience. Clinton students bring new life to old furniture. This article's by Valerie Wells, Clinton. Sophie Thrasher has already found a way to use her newfound skills in furniture repair away from the classroom. She refurbished an American Girl doll bed for her sister because when the family bought the bed, it was hot pink and her sister hated the color. She's part of a Clinton High School class on interior design that includes a project to take old and worn-out pieces and make them new again. The students also learn to make and market their pieces for sale. We had an ag teacher at this school bring us old furniture, and she found at an auction, said Sophie, a freshman at Clinton High School, so we could get the feeling of, even though it's not a huge portion of interior design, if a client said, hey, I really like this piece, but I don't like it in my house, the colors don't fit, but I don't have the experience to do it myself, we have that experience from doing this project. The students learn to strip, sand, and either stain or paint the pieces to make them new again. Sophie's piece was made out of plywood, so the wood grain wasn't suited to staining, and she painted it instead. This project helped us gain experience, so if we need it in the future, even if we don't go into interior design, we can still learn ourselves. If we find a piece of furniture we loved, we can learn to change it to what we like, she said. She also joined Skills USA, an organization that provides hands-on experience for students to help them with job and life skills, and that includes a woodworking competition. You learn what looks good, what looks bad, and what colors fit in a house, she said. I made a table for my woodworking project. I'm always doing projects at home. Teacher Gail Bowman wants the students to learn that they can take something that somebody else has thrown away and transform it. I want them to have the concept that you can take something that's junk and make it nice, whether it's furniture or it's something you've dealt with in life, Bowman said. I want them to have skills that are transferable. A lot of interior design is textbook and theoretical, and that's good too. They need that part too, but I think they have to have some hands-on experience so they feel connected to the material. They have to actually be doing something to know what they want to learn. Just reading the textbook isn't enough. She brought in Nicole Finch, who is the school's in-school suspension supervisor and a substitute teacher whose hobby is interior design, to help show the students how to stage their marketing photos for best results. Rather than just take a photo of a refurbished coffee table, the students put down a rug, placed items on the table, and took photos of it as it would look in someone's home, which makes a piece much more appealing. Whenever we first started on the coffee table, it was in pretty bad shape, said Elijah Lichtenwalter, a freshman. It was covered in dust. It had cobwebs all over it. He and his partner, Lance Brame, discussed the design for a couple of days before beginning work and decided a stencil in the center would make it pop, and chose the colors tan and gray because they are modern and popular now. I'd love to do this for a career in the future, Elijah said. I've always been into fashion and designing and stuff like that. Very large close-up photo here. Sophomore Alora Dallas paints an antique washstand for the upcycled furniture sale with the interior design class at Clinton High School on Friday, April 4th. And the first thing one notices are her eyes. They're focused on the spiral scrolls, and the paintbrush is out of focus. Her face is in focus. Most of the washstand is out of focus. She has her over-ear headphones on, and she looks like she's enjoying the job. Joseph Ressler Photos, Herald and Review. Another smaller color photo. Felix Crit stages furniture for a photo ahead of the upcycled furniture sale with the interior design class at Clinton High School on Friday, April 4th. And it's just around a rug, a basket, some floral arrangements, and then a small wooden rocking chair that's been painted. Very small color photo. Senior Addison Miller shows her refurbished dresser to teacher Gail Bowman ahead of the upcycled furniture sale with the interior design class at Clinton High School on Friday, April 4th. And all we're seeing basically is the top of the dresser. We can see it's a kind of a medium brown wood, but then just a section below it is a kind of a royal blue. And Violet Rowe Ochiltree, Alora Dallas, and Noel Anaya paint furniture pieces for the upcycled furniture sale with the interior design class at Clinton High School on Friday, April 4th. And all Joseph Ressler photos, Herald and Review. Macon County Court's defense attorneys bow out in couple's child abuse images case. Tony Reed Decatur has this article. In a dramatic last-minute development, the Decatur-based law firm, which had defended a Decatur-married couple facing sentencing for possessing images of child sexual abuse, is now off the case. The firm of Bolin, Robinson, and Ellis, known as BRE Law, asked for and received permission from a judge to quit as the attorneys for 54-year-old Kelly Nichols and her husband Douglas Nichols, 56. BRE Law said it had to withdraw after citing, quote, an irreconcilable breakdown in the attorney-client relationship, unquote. Permission to go was given at a Macon County Circuit Court hearing April 4th, and so far the judge in the twin cases, Lindsay Shelton, has not changed the couple's sentencing date of April 24th. The judge has, however, scheduled a status hearing in the cases for April 14th. The legal petition seeking to pull out was signed by attorney Andrew Wessler, who represented the couple along with colleagues Nirupa Patel and Courtney Anderson. The petition was filed separately in the court records of both Kelly and Douglas Nichols. The wording says, Movance and defendant have reached an irreconcilable breakdown in the attorney-client relationship such that it is necessary pursuant to the applicable rules for Movance to immediately withdraw as counsel for defendant. It is in the best interests of Movance and defendant that Movance be permitted to withdraw to allow defendant to obtain new counsel if necessary. And those new defense lawyers are already on board. They are named in court documents as the Chicago-based firm of Robertson Durick. A lawyer for the new firm, Robert Robertson, appeared at the April 4th hearing via Zoom conference call. Robertson did not immediately return a message seeking comment, and neither did Wessler with BRE Law. A webpage detailing Robertson's experience says he is a veteran of more than 100 jury trials and formerly taught the trial advocacy course to second and third year law students at Northwestern University School of Law. His firm takes over cases where Kelly and Douglas Nichols stand convicted of 10 counts each of possession of images of child sexual abuse after an October bench trial. Kelly Nichols, however, also was found guilty of recording a pornographic video of a girl under the age of 13. That is a Class X felony, and while her husband could get probation for his offenses, the judge has no choice but to sentence Kelly Nichols to prison. And in a separate case on his own, Douglas Nichols is pleading not guilty to 4 counts of aggravated sexual assault and 8 counts of criminal sexual abuse of a victim under the age of 18. That case is scheduled for a status hearing April 14th. The history of all the cases involving the couple is linked together, however. It was while Decatur Police Department detectives were investigating the allegations against Douglas Nichols that they came across images and movies that became the subject of the child pornography charges. Front page, Illinois Scott's Law. Drivers still fail to move over 2 decades into law. Police deaths, injuries still occurring. The circles by Beth Hunsdorfer, Capital News, Illinois, Springfield. For a moment, Illinois State Trooper Alex Womack was flying, tumbling in midair, alternately seeing the sky, then the ground. He doesn't remember hitting the road. He regained consciousness and realized he had been hit by a truck and was lying in the middle of a darkened interstate near East St. Louis, unable to move, with cars traveling 70 miles an hour headed toward him. He remembers seeing the oncoming headlights. I was able to raise my one arm off the ground, Womack said. An oncoming driver saw his upraised arm in his headlights and slammed on the brakes, managing to stop just feet away. That shaken driver pulled the injured trooper off the roadway to safety. Womack had just become the 19th of 26 Illinois state troopers involved in a Scott's Law crash in 2019, a year when two troopers were killed and a dozen, including Womack, were injured. Those crashes spurred legislative changes and heightened public awareness campaigns. Scott's Law, also known as the Move Over Law, requires that all vehicles move over, if possible, or slow down when passing a stopped or disabled emergency vehicle with its flashing lights on. It was passed in 2001. Since 2019, state police have been involved in 140 crashes caused by drivers violating the Move Over Law. In 2024, there were more crashes than in the past 5 years, 27 in all, including a fatal collision that killed Trooper Troy Clay Carnes, an 11-year veteran and father of two. Carnes died December 23, 2024, after he was struck while clearing debris from the highway after a crash on Interstate 55 near Chanahan. The crash that killed Carnes happened 24 years to the day after Chicago Fire Department Lieutenant Scott Gillen died after he was struck by a passing car at an accident scene. The legislation that later became known as Scott's Law was named for Gillen. The 2019 deaths of the two troopers in an 8-week period once again put the Move Over Law in the spotlight. On January 12, 2019, Trooper Christopher Lambert died after a crash on Interstate 294 in Cook County. On March 28, 2019, Trooper Brooke Jones Story died in a crash on US 20 in Stevenson County. One of Brendan Kelly's first duties as the newly appointed director of the Illinois State Police was delivering the eulogy at Jones Story's funeral. Since then, one of Kelly's missions has been to educate the public on the Move Over Law, including enforcement details to ticket violators and campaigns to educate drivers. In 2019, ISP issued nearly 6,300 citations for violating the Move Over Law, which was nearly 5,300 more than the combined totals of the two previous years. We will continue to hammer home this message as long as it takes, because this is a matter of life and death for our officers and for the safety of the public, Kelly said. A person who violates the Move Over Law now faces a minimum fine of $250 up to a maximum of $10,000 for a first offense. If the violation results in an injury to another person, the violator's driver's license will be suspended for up to 2 years. In the wake of the 2019 deaths, Governor J.B. Pritzker formed a task force that recommended changes in the law and stiffer penalties for violators, improvements in protective equipment and lighting for trooper and public awareness campaigns. 3 days after the task force released its first report, there was another crash. On February 15, 2021, Trooper Brian Frank, with his marked squad car's emergency lights activated, stopped in the left lane of Interstate 55 northbound near Route 30. Near Joliet to block traffic for a crash that had just occurred. While still inside his squad car, a black Cadillac struck the rear of Trooper Frank's squad car, leaving him with serious brain injuries. Lauren Frank, Trooper Frank's wife, became an advocate for the Move Over Law, including advocating for a bill on August 12, 2021, that strengthened the penalties against violators. Brian Frank continues to recover from his catastrophic brain injury and remains in a minimally conscious state. Brian Angel Casillas, the driver who hit Frank, received a 15-month prison sentence. The Move Over Law protections were further expanded this year. Beginning on January 1st, drivers must change lanes, reduce speed, or stop when approaching or passing any emergency vehicle, including police, sheriff, ambulances, and maintenance vehicles with the flashing lights activated. Drivers are also required to yield the right-of-way to any authorized vehicle or pedestrian actively engaged in work on a highway or construction zone. ISP is also employing technology to reduce Scott's Law crashes. Late last year, the agency announced a partnership with Haas Alert, that's H-A-A-S Alert, a company that provides safety alerts to drivers, notifying them of ISP activity in the road ahead and urging them to slow down and move over. Haas provides real-time GPS-based traffic information in Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Mercedes-Benz, Ram, and Volkswagen vehicles. ISP provides information about crashes, traffic stops, motorist assists, or debris on the roadway, which is then pushed out to in-vehicle GPS systems. As drivers approach the GPS location of the trooper, they will see a police icon and receive an alert to slow down and move over. ISP also partnered with Google to provide notifications in Google and Waze Maps to expand the alerts on their platforms. So far this year, there have been 4 crashes in Illinois, injuring 3 troopers. Womack, the state trooper who was struck in March 2019, sustained a broken femur, humerus, compressed discs in his vertebrae. He underwent 2 surgeries and months of physical therapy. He didn't return to work full duties for more than a year, and he said he was thankful to be alive. By the grace of God, I was saved. It just wasn't my time to go, Womack said. Kyamron B. Makhardze, 26, the truck driver who hit Womack, was charged with aggravated driving under the influence and aggravated reckless driving. He pleaded guilty in 2023 and received a year in prison. Womack returned to work after months of recovery. Today, he said, when he pulls over drivers for violating the move-over law, he tells them what happened to him. I hope it's a lesson, Womack said. I work on the side of the road. That's my office. And at the end of the day, I just want to go home. Large color photo here. Illinois State Police Director Brendan Kelly hands a flag to Megan Carnes, the widow of Trooper Clay Carnes. Who died December 23, 2024. John Fleet, 69, of Wilmington, was charged with violating Scott's Law, which is a Class 4 felony. Provided photo. Trooper Alex Womack stands behind his wrecked squad car. Womack sustained arm, leg, and back injuries and required more than a year off of work to recover. The vehicle is on a flatbed and it's unrecognizable. There's just one tire shown and the rest of it is just a mangled mess. And where it says state police, in between state and police, there's a huge dent and everything else around it is mangled. It's remarkable that he survived. Provided photo by Illinois State Police. Nation and world, Trump's trade war answers to tariff questions. President says taxes on U.S. imports will level the playing field. Christopher Rugeber and Paul Wiseman, Associated Press. After weeks of anticipation and speculation, President Donald Trump followed through on his tariff threats by declaring a 10% baseline tax on imports from all countries and higher tariff rates on dozens of nations that run trade surpluses with the United States. In announcing what he called reciprocal tariffs on April 2nd, Trump fulfilled a key campaign promise by raising U.S. taxes on foreign goods to narrow the gap with the tariffs, the White House says, other countries unfairly impose on U.S. products. Trump's higher rates would hit foreign entities that sell more goods to the United States than they buy. But economists don't share Trump's enthusiasm for tariffs, since they're a tax on importers that usually get passed on to consumers. It's possible, however, that the reciprocal tariffs could bring other countries to the table and get them to lower their own import taxes. The Associated Press asked for your questions about reciprocal tariffs. Here are a few of them along with our answers. Do U.S. collected tariffs go into the General Revenue Fund? Can Trump withdraw money from that fund without oversight? Tariffs are taxes on imports collected when foreign goods cross the U.S. border by the Customs and Border Protection Agency. That money, about $80 billion last year, goes to the U.S. Treasury to help pay the federal government's expenses. Congress has authority to say how the money will be spent. Trump, largely supported by Republican lawmakers who control the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, wants to use increased tariff revenue to finance tax cuts that analysts say would disproportionately benefit the wealthy. Specifically, they want to extend tax cuts passed in Trump's first term and largely set to expire at the end of 2025. The Tax Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, has found that extending Trump's tax cuts would reduce federal revenue by $4.5 trillion from 2025 to 2034. Trump wants higher tariffs to help offset lower tax collections. Another think tank, the Tax Policy Center, has said that extending the 2017 tax cuts would deliver continued tax relief to Americans at all income levels, but higher income households would receive a larger benefit. How soon will prices rise as a result of the tariff policy? It depends on how businesses both in the United States and overseas respond, but consumers could see overall pricing rising within a month or two of tariffs being imposed. For some products, such as produce from Mexico, prices could rise more quickly after the tariffs take effect. Some U.S. retailers and other importers may eat part of the cost of the tariffs, and overseas exporters may reduce their prices to offset the extra duties. But for many businesses, the tariffs Trump announced April 2nd, such as 20% on imports from Europe, will be too large to swallow on their own. Companies may also use the tariffs as an excuse to raise prices. When Trump slapped duties on washing machines in 2018, studies later showed that retailers raised prices on both washers and dryers, even though there were no new duties on dryers. A key question in the coming months is whether something similar will happen. Economists worry that consumers, having just lived through the biggest inflationary spike in four decades, are more accustomed to rising prices than they were before the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet, there are also signs that Americans, put off by the rise in the cost of living, are less willing to accept price increases and will simply cut back on their purchases. That could discourage businesses from raising prices by much. What is the limit of the executive branch's power to implement tariffs? Does Congress not play a role? The U.S. Constitution grants the power to set tariffs to Congress, but over the years, Congress delegated those powers to the president through several laws. Those laws specify the circumstances under which the White House can impose tariffs, which are typically limited to cases where imports threaten national security or are severely harming a specific industry. In the past, presidents generally imposed tariffs only after carrying out public hearings to determine if certain imports met those criteria. Trump followed those steps when imposing tariffs in his first term. In his second term, however, Trump has sought to use emergency powers set out in a 1977 law to impose tariffs in a more ad hoc fashion. Trump said, for example, that fentanyl flowing from Canada and Mexico constitutes a national emergency, and used that pretext to impose 25% duties on goods from both countries. Congress can seek to cancel an emergency that a president declares, and Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, proposed to do just that regarding Canada. That legislation passed in the Senate, but would likely die in the House. Other bills in Congress that also would limit the president's authority to set tariffs face tough odds for passage as well. Trade war threatens U.S. craft brewers, Deanne Durbin and Paul Wiseman, AP Business Writers. America's craft brewers already have enough problems. Hard seltzers and cocktails are muscling into beer sales. Millennials and Gen Z don't drink as much as their elders. Brew pubs still haven't fully recovered from the shock of COVID-19 5 years ago. Now there's a new threat. President Donald Trump's tariffs, including levies of 25% on imported steel and aluminum and on goods from Canada and Mexico. It's going to cost the industry a substantial amount of money, said Matt Cole, a brewmaster at Ohio-based Fatheads Brewery. Trump's trade war will be crippling for our industry if this carries out into months and years. The tariffs could impact brewers in big ways and small, said Bart Watson, president and CEO of the Brewers Association, the trade group for craft beer. Aluminum cans are in Trump's crosshairs, and nearly all the steel kegs used by U.S. brewers are made in Germany, so a tariff on finished steel products raises the cost of kegs. Tariffs on Canadian products like barley and malt would also increase costs, and some brewers depend on raspberries and other fruit from Mexico, Watson said. At Port City Brewing in Alexandria, Virginia, founder Bill Butcher worries that he'll have to raise the price of a six-pack of his best-selling Optimal Wit and other brews to $18.99 from around $12.99 and to charge more for a pint at his tasting room. Are people still going to come here and pay $12 for a pint instead of $8? He said. Our business will slow down. For Port City, the biggest threat comes from the looming tariff on Canadian imports. Every 3 weeks, the brewery receives a 40,000-pound truckload of Pilsner malt from Canada, which goes into a 55,000-pound silo on the brewery's grounds. Butcher said he can't find malt of comparable quality anywhere else. Trump's tariffs also hit Port City in a roundabout way. The levy on aluminum, which went into effect March 12th, is causing big brewers to switch from aluminum cans to bottles. Port City, which bottles 70% of its beer, found itself unable to get bottles. "Our bottle supplier is cutting us off at the end of the month," Butcher said. "That caught us by surprise." Fathead's Brewery gets its barley from Canada. Cole said it could shift to sources in Idaho and Montana, but the shipping logistics are more complicated. And Trump's tariffs, by putting Canadian barley at a competitive disadvantage, would allow U.S. producers to raise domestic prices. Fathead is trying to mitigate the impact of the tariffs, anticipating higher aluminum prices, for instance. The brewery stockpiled beer cans, which it gets from a U.S. supplier, and now has 3 million cans in its warehouse, 30% of what it needs annually. It has also shifted production to painted cans, which are cheaper than those with shrink-wrapped film sleeves. In Arizona, some brewers are already eliminating or reducing the beers they offer in aluminum cans to cut costs, said Cale Aylesworth, the director of sales and relations at OHSO Brewery and Distillery and president of the Arizona Craft Brewers Guild. "This is a blow to Arizona craft. I hate to see less local options on the shelf," Aylesworth said. Some brewers have also lost access to store shelves from one big customer, Canada, which is the top foreign market for U.S. craft beer, accounting for almost 38% of exports. But Canadians are furious that Trump targeted their products, and Canadian importers have been canceling orders and pulling U.S. beer off store shelves. The tariffs come at an already difficult time for brewers. After years of steady growth, the number of U.S. breweries more than doubled to 9,736 between 2014 and 2024. The industry is struggling to compete with seltzers and other beverages and to win over younger customers. In 2024, brewery closings outnumbered openings for the first time since the mid-2000s, Watson of the Brewers Association said. He estimates that U.S. craft beer production dipped 2% to 3% last year. Craft brewing had a period of phenomenal growth, but we are not in that era anymore, he said. We're in a more mature market. Port City production peaked in 2019 at 16,000 barrels of beer, equivalent to 220,000 cases. Then COVID hit and hammered the company's draft beer business in bars and restaurants. The comeback has been slow. Butcher expects Port City to produce 13,000 barrels this year. The brewery seeks to set itself apart by emphasizing its award-winning brews. In 2015, Port City was named Small Brewer of the Year at the Great American Beer Festival, but it isn't easy with import taxes threatening to raise the cost of ingredients and packaging. It's hard enough to run a small business when your supply chain is intact, he said, and the erratic way that Trump has rolled out the taxes, announcing them, then suspending them, then threatening new ones, has made it even more difficult to plan. The unpredictability just injects an element of chaos, Butcher said. Aylesworth in Arizona said big brewers have whole teams of people to calculate the impact of tariffs, but small brewers must stretch their resources to navigate them. That's on top of other complexities of running a brewery, from zoning laws to licensing permits to labor shortages. But for many brewers, the heaviest burden right now is lower sales as customers cut back on beer, Aylesworth said. That's why many brewers are trying hard not to raise prices. In today's world, with the economy and the high level of uncertainty, people are spending less, Cole said. Beer is an affordable luxury, and we want to make sure we don't lose that. And that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, April 8th, 2025. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.